Well, welcome everyone to book study session number 8 of 10. We are 80% of the way through our time together and through this wonderful book by Bhikkhu Bodhi and the Buddha, acknowledged Buddha also. And also wanted to start out by thanking and acknowledging last week's presenters, Bill and Tetsuho and Ekudo and Jules, for leading the conversation last week. This evening, we're going to really be focusing on chapter number 8, Mastering the Mind. And Sokyo and I are going to share a brief kind of overview of the contents of the chapter as a refresher to those of you that have read it over a few days, and kind of give you our distillation of that. And then we really wanted to open up the conversation and have it driven by the book group members. In doing so, we're hoping that you'll address the two questions that we sent out earlier to you this week, which are in the chat. The first has to do with identifying something within this chapter that spoke to you directly, that you thought was important and that relates to your practice. And then the second thing that we ask you to do is to pose a question to the group of something that struck your curiosity that you would like the group to respond to. So we'll get to that as soon as we've done a chapter overview, and Sokyo is going to begin by doing the first half of the chapter.
Thanks, Dave. Chodo-san, sorry. Hold on, I just need to get this going here. In Mastering the Mind, as a natural follow-up to last chapter's theme of training through moral discipline and the undertaking of the precepts, in this week's chapter, Mastering of the Mind, Bhikkhu Bodhi delves deeply into the practicalities of deep meditation to enable wisdom, and he provides numerous lists and explicit techniques in how to challenge your own mind during distractions. He starts by explaining that the foundation for mastering the mind is a developed mind, which in the Nikayas means a mind that is serene and capable of insight. And a developed mind gives rise to happiness, freedom, and peace. An uncultivated mind, however, is where greed, hatred, and delusion easily fester. Buddha mentions that when serenity is developed, the mind is developed. And when insight is developed, wisdom is developed. Therefore, the pairing of serenity and insight together is considered true knowledge. In this state, all lust, meaning clinging, cravings, and wants, as well as ignorance, meaning closed-mindedness, wrong views, and fear and hatred, are abandoned. Ananda then goes on to describe the various combinations of experiencing serenity and insight in your practice. In the four ways to arahantship, I hope I'm saying that correctly, one can experience one followed by the other, or at the same time, or lastly, and this is my personal favorite, one's mind can be seized by agitation by the teaching. But depending on the person that experiences any of these four ways just mentioned, there's still plenty of opportunity to only adapt either or serenity or insight as prescribed, or neither. However, achieving both is the place to be, according to Buddha, and they should establish themselves in this state and keep going. In a conversation between Sangharava and Buddha, Sangharava raises the question of why one sometimes can't recall known information, or conversely, why one sometimes can immediately recall lesser known information. Buddha responds that if the mind is muddled by any of the five hindrances, one's mind is not clear and cannot readily recall known things. The five hindrances being sensual lust, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and finally doubt, all of which are pretty much what I experience in my daily life. So If Sangharava were here today, perhaps the question would be, why do I sometimes go into a room and forget why I'm there? So the process of refining the mind is then compared to melting and refining the impurities out of gold through successive iterations. In order to achieve a higher mind, one must purge the following impurities over time: bad conduct of body, speech, and mind. These are the gross impurities. Then onto a series of lesser impurities: sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harming, thoughts of relatives, home, country, and his or her reputation. Finally, the last impurity are thoughts about the teachings, but with strenuous suppression of the defilements. With all of these human impurities removed, one now has a calm mind of unification. I think this is referred to as samadhi, if I'm not mistaken. From here, one's Zen superpowers are unlocked, giving one the ability to be one with many, mind travel beyond the cushion, hear divine and human sounds, understand the minds of other beings, other people, recollect past lives, and see beings passing away and being reborn. This is the taintless, liberated mind. According to Buddha, there are five signs to heed, or rather five techniques to still the mind. When unwholesome thoughts arise, meet them with opposing wholesome thoughts, or identify them, such as, that was an unwholesome thought. Both of these techniques will help to steady the mind. Two other techniques mentioned were to try to forget them and not pay attention. Or this could be a way of saying letting them come and go in the mind. And also questioning the cause of the unwholesome thoughts, saying to yourself, where did this thought come from? Finally, if all else fails and desire, hate, and delusion continue to persist, even when trying to still one's thoughts, crush mind with mind, Buddha says, just as a strong person might seize a weaker one by the head or shoulders and beat them down, constrain them, and crush them. This approach was a bit of a surprise for me. I haven't tried that one. And now Dave will continue.
In the section entitled The Mind of Loving Kindness, Buddha instructs the monks that others may address them with five types of speech, that some of the speech may be untrue, meant to harm, or spoken in a mood of hate. Regardless of what is spoken, he instructs the monks that their minds should remain unaffected, and that they should respond with loving kindness, uttering no bitter words, abiding in compassion for the speaker. Further, he provides the simile of the saw, that if bandits were severing the monk's limbs with a saw, the monk's mind should not respond with hate or ill will, but with a mind of loving kindness and compassion for the welfare of the attacker, and that those thoughts of goodwill should pervade the all-encompassing world. This brought to mind another great teacher, Christ's famous instructions from the book of Matthew about turning the other cheek when confronted with violence. The chapter's review of the six recollections provides Buddha's response to questions about how a disciple dwells when he or she arrives at the fruit that has understood the teaching. Bhikkhu Bodhi clarifies in footnote that the fruit and understanding refer to meditation practice that's available to anyone, monk or householder. Here the teachings enumerate six recollections where the noble disciple dwells, and he notes that these are indications of stream entry. Acknowledgement of the enlightenment of the Buddha is the first, which removes lust, hatred, and illusion. The inspiration of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha, those disciples of the Blessed One who are worthy and deserving of gifts and hospitality. The noble disciple also dwells in his or her moral discipline and a mind that is not obsessed with lust, hatred, and delusion. The fifth recollection is dwelling in generosity and giving. And the sixth is recollecting the Devas and their example of faith, moral discipline, learning, generosity, and wisdom that has led to their being born into heavenly realms. This section seems to echo the precepts that so many of us have studied. The chapter establishes then a deep dive into the four establishments of mindfulness. It begins with a statement by Buddha to the monks that these teachings and practice are a one-way path for purification of beings, surmounting sorrow and lamentation, and for the passing away of pain and dejection, for attainment of the true way, ultimately for the realization of Nibbana. In a footnote, Bhikkhu Bodhi shares that in some translations, this one-way path is seen as exclusive, that is, this is the only way. But he notes that in other Nikayas and translations, it might be understood just to say, it only moves in one direction, you just move forward on the path. The four mindfulness establishments include contemplating body in the body, contemplating feelings in feelings, contemplating mind in mind, contemplating phenomena in phenomena. So why the repetition? Why body in the body? Why not just contemplate body? The author indicates that the teaching seems to convey that the four categories are exclusive. That is, the body is just a body. It's not a man, it's not a woman, it's not a self. It's not a body with inherent feelings or mind. It's just a body. By extension, the same would hold true for feelings, mind, and phenomena. In contemplation of the body, a lot of tools are provided, and this chapter reads like the book of lists, and it's kind of such an illustration of the way the Buddha taught. Contemplation of breathing, contemplation of posture, clear comprehension of the body and the way that it moves, stretches, eats, chews, drinks water, talks, etc. And here I was reminded of the Buddhist proverb about just being aware of chopping wood or carrying water or just doing the dishes. Contemplation of the unattractiveness of the body. Again, not linking the self to the body, but essentially seeing the body as a bag open at both ends, filled with rice, beans, and other items, such as organs, grease, snot, poop, and other unattractive things. Also described as contemplation of elements of the body, earth, water, and the air elements. The chapter goes on to describe nine contemplations of the body in the charnel or burial ground and provides vivid language about decomposition of the body. All of our bodies will eventually go through that, again differentiating ourself from that body that will disintegrate. The second establishment of mindfulness is contemplation of feelings. This is a short section. Monks are instructed to see and recognize feelings, pleasant or unpleasant, carnal or pleasant, spiritual and pleasant, and so forth. The point is made that the monk sees the feeling arising and sees it vanishing, but like the body, recognizes that it's not permanent or tangible. The third establishment is contemplation of mind, seeing one's mental activity, exalted or unexalted, concentrated or unconcentrated, but like body and feelings, what we think is mind arises and vanishes and has no enduring quality. The fourth establishment of mindfulness, contemplation of phenomena, begins with enumeration of five hindrances or impediments to concentration and insight: sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. The point here is to see the hindrances clearly, how they arise, how they are abandoned, and once abandoned, how they do not arise in the future. The noble disciple at this level of contemplation dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. Another contemplation of phenomena is to view the five aggregates and to understand their origin and passing away. This is followed by contemplation of the six sense bases: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, and once seen and understood as impermanent, non-self, the fetters they give rise to are abandoned. For me, this was a really strong echo of the Heart Sutra. Another contemplation of phenomena, Buddha shares seven enlightenment factors: mindfulness enlightenment, phenomena enlightenment, rapture enlightenment, tranquility enlightenment, concentration enlightenment, equanimity enlightenment. Monks are encouraged to develop these enlightenments, and the footnote references their connection to spiritual maturity. The Four Noble Truths is also presented by Buddha as a way of contemplating phenomena. In concluding teaching regarding the four establishments of mindfulness, Buddha indicates that should it take 7 years or 7 days, realizing of these establishments is the realization of nirvana. The final sections of the chapter focus on mindfulness of breathing and the achievement of mastery. Here the chapter revisits teachings presented earlier that focuses on awareness of breathing in and breathing out and awareness of impermanence that contribute to concentration, mindfulness, and fulfillment of the seven factors of enlightenment. This is seen as leading to true knowledge and liberation. The conclusion of the chapter involves a conversation between Venerable Shariputra and Venerable Ananda. In it, Shariputra describes his entering particular states of awareness, including the four jhanas, transcending of the perception of forms, awareness of the infinity of space, awareness of the consciousness as infinite, awareness of the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception or non-perception, the cessation of perception and feeling. With each dwelling or abiding, Shariputra notes that it did not occur to him that he had attained anything. Ananda concluded that it must be because I-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to conceit has been thoroughly uprooted for such a long time that such thoughts did not occur. Again, the section echoes the Heart Sutra and also the progression development of spiritual maturity that accompanies the journey on the path. So that is our overview of a very interesting and rich chapter. Now it's your turn. So what we would hope for and encourage, I hope I'm not stealing your thunder here.
No, not at all. Be my guest.
Is really to have the rest of this conversation around this chapter on mastery of mind, on meditation, and on how this relates to our practice, really to be driven by your comments and reactions to it. And so we had sent out two questions. The first being, is there something that really touched you or stood out or resonated for you in the chapter, and how does it relate to your practice? And then the second was, is there a question that arose for you that you'd like to pose to our book group? And so it's open mic time, and we would prefer not to call on people. We're hoping people will volunteer, but
we will resort to that.
But we will resort to that, yeah, exactly.
Raise your hand before we
ask you. please raise your hand and save us the pain of calling on you. And we will outweigh you.
Do you want to go?
Oh, Jackie.
I think it's Jackie. Jackie?
Can you highlight this?
Yeah, here we go. I'll do this.
So I liked a lot of things about this, but there are things about it like the unattractiveness of the body. We have to not be liking our bodies. And the detachment from, even in the end, you let go of joy and ease and you're left with, you know, why? I just don't, it feels like it's taking all the color away and leaving me with something bloodless, or I don't know, it doesn't feel good, and it doesn't reflect my experience of practice at Jokoji, you know, in so it feels so different to me that we have to be abstracting ourselves from our bodily existence. And so that made me uncomfortable. And I'd like to know what advice people can give me about that topic or other thoughts. Thanks.
Thank you for a great question. Who would like to take a run at that.
I could do that.
Okay, Tova is with us.
I have a question about our format.
Yeah.
However, are we going to be commenting on each other in real time, or are we going to save that?
No, let's do it in real time. I think in real time. I think this should be as much of a dialogue as we can develop.
Okay. Well,
would you like to come closer?
If everyone can see me and hear me, that's fine. I don't need to move unless you need me to. Do you need me to move?
Can you all hear her?
Can you hear me, Jackie? And everyone? Hi. I'm going to respond to you with my heart and body, because I think there was a bit of that missing. This was an austere teaching to residential monks, I believe. And I think what I'll give is what I've pretty much prepared. I don't need to be reading a bunch that I have prepared, but what struck me most was about the use of the breath. And if we look at the Buddha at that time, who is referring to himself as Tathagata, that's his fondness for his fond reference to himself, from what I have gathered. He probably had learned pranayama. It was part of the tradition that he was proceeding beyond. So I have to believe that all of those practices that we learn in our yoga practice were available to him and were understood. And when we hear that he was saying that those practices were enough to lead one to enlightenment, that he called it the Tathagata's dwelling, and that ability to use the breath can culminate in permanent liberation of the mind. And when I look at the use of the breath, we're linking the mind and the body. So we are in reverence of that cycle. All of our cells are saturated every moment that we're breathing with everything in the universe, in the known universe, that we know of that sustains life. So we're in total interbeing every time we're breathing. And to me, that is so vibrant and so much a part of our living existence that I can't abstract it into the practices that require so much mental activity. That were, you know, those ideas of the two-handed saw and the clenching of the teeth and all of those violent images. The breath can be gentle, it can be vibrant, it can be a way to slow ourselves down or speed ourselves up. It's total essence of health. And so that's what I get in response to the reading. I kept going back to that and to your comment. And I put that out as my question, and then I will be done here probably, my turn. I put that out as the question to each of us as the second part of our assignment, is what were the practices of all of those that are such a wonderful compilation of individual ways to go at our own liberation? What were those that spoke to you most?
Taishin, I see you indicating that you're ready to jump in.
Yeah, thank you. And I thought I would take a swing at offering a response to Jackie's question by saying I felt similarly that all the fun started to be sucked out of practice in reading this chapter. And you mentioned that that's not your experience practicing at Chikoji. It's certainly not my experience practicing out here at Owan and Nenzen and Jiro. I think can both attest to that. There's lots of joy and color out here. I felt it particularly strongly when reading the simile of the saw which Chodo mentioned, you know, even if bandits were sawing me limb from limb, still my mind will remain unaffected and I will have unbounded loving kindness for the band. No, probably not. I'd like to think that. I mean, there's something attractive about that. So a question I was sitting with is, how do I take some of these passages seriously, but not literally? Is there a message that is being offered, but if I just take it at face value, I'm going to miss it? Because again, in that instance, being sawed limb from limb, it just doesn't seem to reflect what my actual experience is. So I need to find another way to approach what's being offered in the teachings.
Patty?
In response to that, Taishin, he follows that up, that thing about being, you know, having your arms sawed off. He follows that up with, if you keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? I think he was just trying to give some perspective. And I thought about how helpful that would have been for me during my working life when, you know, I was a teacher and I was not prepared for what an emotional place schools are. And I'm talking about the staff, I'm talking about my colleagues and how hurtful comments can be and how if I could have had some perspective about that, this whole passage would have been very helpful to me. So I don't know if that makes it look a little different or not. I doubt if they're literally saying, if somebody's sawing your arms off, you should still think, I love you, I care about you. That would be impossible for me to do also. But to maybe think, you know, nothing could hurt you as badly as that could. Nothing anybody says. The sticks and stones thing. But I wanted to mention something that I really enjoyed, and it was in the hindrances to mental development in that whole section. It's an extended metaphor. I loved the literary device that was used in explaining this, because it says, you know, a mind obsessed by sensual lust is a bowl of water mixed with red, yellow, blue, or crimson dye. The bowl of water being heated over a fire, bubbling and boiling, that's a mind obsessed by ill will. And it goes on and on. A bowl of water covered over with water, plants, and algae is a mind obsessed by dullness and drowsiness. So after I noticed the first three of those, I just couldn't wait to get to the next one and see, okay, what's the metaphor going to be for the next one? A bowl of water stirred by the wind, rippling, swirling, churned into wavelets. That's a mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse. And there is a bowl of water that is turbid, unsettled, muddy, placed in the dark. That's a mind obsessed by doubt. But the clear, serene, limpid bowl of water, of course, is the one that doesn't have any of those hindrances. So then I thought, okay, well, that's nice that you liked it, but how does it help you with your practice? Because that was the tricky part of the question, was not just something that you liked, but how does that help you with your practice? And I just, I think those kinds of devices help me remember. Help me remember, because, and that leads, segues into my question, you know, it's the five hindrances, and it's the eight of these and the four of those and the seven divided into two parts of all of the, you know, it's the lists and lists and lists. And I think all of those things are important, but I can't just recall, I mean, some of, with this reading and with all of your input, I'm starting to recognize things and go, oh yeah, that's that, and that's, you know, the four jhanas and the, all of that. But there's just so much. There's so much, so many lists and so many numbered items. And so, I mean, I would like a reference. I would like a reference book. Does anybody know of one? I would like a book where you go to the index and you go, the four jhanas, page 74. You go to page 74 and there they are. So if such a thing exists and you know about it, please tell me.
Aiken's glossary.
Oh, say that again.
Patty, thank you so much. And my mind is whirling here. And fortunately, Bill has put his hands together. So, and is going to be our index, I think. Yes, Bill?
I have an index for you. It's listed numerically, and it's about 10 pages long. There may be five or six different ones and so on. I'll dig it out and I'll make it available. I've had it for years. It's also in most indexes to the Prajnaparamita, some of the other sutras that are translated. And so if you have any of those around, sometimes there's an index in those that spreads those out. And to answer your question more substantially, the Abhidharma in its various forms is an organization of all of those levels and those numbers and so on. And it's very big and vast, and you know, it's a map of the universe.
What is
but
that?
You can, it's called the Abhidharma, it's the third basket. There's the Vinaya, the discipline, the words of the Buddha, the Dharma, Sutra. And the Abhidharma, Abhidamma in Pali. Pali has, the Sri Lanka version is very clear. It's a small book. It's like an index, but it lists each of those things that are coming up in the sutra. It was an attempt, a lot of people must have felt what you felt. There's too many numbers here. What do I do with all these? So these people got together and sorted it all out and organized it in their various copies. I'll try and link you with some of these, if it's important to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill.
Bill, while you have the floor, and I see Anton's ready to jump in, but Bill, was there something in the reading that got to you? A takeaway or an insight that something that touched you in the reading that maybe you hadn't considered before? You might be muted, Bill.
Two or three places caught my attention. One that I kind of enjoyed, I guess enjoyment is the right word for it, was let me see where it is. Oh, most of this chapter is about meditation. For example, the burning and all of those things. Those are things that a monk who has the time to sit around all day and think about those things. In the Theravada tradition, they're pretty much unoccupied. They don't make their own food. They meditate on these things or study them actually as well. Most of it's about mind training. That's what the chapter is about, mind training. But the interesting part to me was when they extended it out of the meditation hall into actions in the real world. And it sounds like this was for monks as well. So the first one was it's a four-phase cycle. Well, let me see. if you're going to maintain your mindfulness, to set out on daily activities or anything that you happen to do. First, this is called the four types of clear comprehension. That's, I think, footnote 34 will connect you with that section. First one that one might ask oneself, what's the purpose of what I'm doing now? Does it further my goal? Be conscious of purpose. And I think about that maybe once every 2 months. That's stuff I do. What this is suggesting that you do this on a regular basis. But then the next thing it goes to is the suitability. Are you in a place where you can do that? Maybe you can. But maybe it requires some alteration in how you think about, stay mindful of what you're doing. The domain. What part of the world are you in when you're doing this? That's number three. Daily, that's particularly activities. And the fourth one is like the fourth jhana. Who's doing it? So, again, like all of these other things, they may be a bit extreme, but you could do that every moment of the day or every activity you engage in. But as a general guideline, I found it rather nice. I can't say it blew me away, but an approach that one might take. I often think about how do I apply this in everything I do? Well, here's one way to do it, not just in the meditation hall. And that's the thing about this whole chapter. It's not one meditation. There are eight different meditations or ways to do this, and it depends on the personality type. So a hate-filled person, what was the antidote to that? So what it's getting at is that there are different practices for different people. So I think about, why are we doing shikantaza? Is that what we're doing? Or am I doing something else when I'm practicing Zen? And I would be willing to try some of these practices. In fact, I have on occasion. The breathing practice, I think, is a non-shikantaza sort of thing. I asked Chris if he thought it was like shikantaza. He says, no, you still got an object there. It's not going to work. But taking an object, that's, oh, and then one other one that impressed me, and then I'll drop it. No, I'll leave it alone now. I've said enough. If there's time at the end, I'll come back to it. It's not connected to what I just said. So I release the object.
Thank you.
Tetsuho, and then Anton. Oh, or maybe not Anton, I see your head shaking. So Tetsuho, definitely.
Hi, I really enjoyed this chapter. And what struck me particularly was talking about the various ways, I think, to a developed mind, and talking about particularly serenity and insight, and how some meditators will, I don't know if you said master, but approach serenity first and then insight. Some will approach insight first and then serenity. Some will do both at the same time, and some will do Mariko's favorite, which is I think she said agitation towards the Dharma, and in some, you know, some way go from there. I've worked with the sutra on the awareness of breathing, which is very much like the Sutra on the Four Establishments of Mindfulness, only less, it goes in less in depth in the Four Establishments. It mostly focuses on a cycle of various levels of meditation based on breathing. So there's 16 parts, and I've done it quite a bit over the last year or two. And the thing that was just marvelous for me is it starts off with awareness of your breath. I'm aware that I'm breathing long, I'm aware that I'm breathing short, then awareness of the body, then calming the body. And then the next cycle of meditations is I feel joy. In the chapter, he calls it rapture, but I feel joy. I breathe in, I feel joy. I breathe out, I feel joy. And then I breathe in, I feel happiness. I breathe out, I feel happiness. And so when I first started doing this, I was like, how do you feel joy, you know, just like that? Isn't joy something that just happens? Well, I discovered it doesn't just happen. I had a talk with my teacher about this because I felt like I generated the joy and I generated the happiness. And my teacher felt that maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe there was joy and happiness there. In any event, somehow I was able to access the joy. And then in the next exercise, I was able to access the happiness. And I can pretty much do that every time I sit down and do this meditation. And what I discovered was that for me was the key to all of a sudden going much like like in an elevator. Maybe in the old elevators, sometimes you have a whoops, you know, like it just. And so for me, that was kind of like a in meditation. So it really settled me. It settled me to the next part of the meditation, which was awareness of feelings, then awareness of the mind, making the mind happy, awareness of concentration, liberation, awareness of impermanence, and blah, blah, blah. So the whole point of this is that I really appreciated the part where they talk about the serenity and the insight and how helpful it was for me to focus on serenity because it took me to insight, I think. So that was my comment. And my question for the class is kind of like Bill's. And we talked about this last night. How does our practice of Zazen relate to this chapter, to the meditation instructions in this chapter, or how does it not relate? What is your experience in Zazen? It seems Zazen is, sometimes I'm wondering whether Zazen is meditation or not. I'm not 100% sure. I don't know. I have a feeling of how it's related, how the Buddha's teaching as far as the Four Establishments of Mindfulness and our Zazen could be related. But I'm really curious on your experience of Zazen and holding it up to the teachings in this chapter. Thank you.
It's a great question, Bill. I'm so glad you asked it. And we're staring at everyone on the screen, hoping that you're ready to jump in on this, because it's such a profound question of the way that we are, I think, the way that I was instructed in Zazen and Shikantaza is quite different from the outline of meditation as presented in this chapter, and I wonder how you reconcile or use the best of all of those teachings. So please, someone jump in. And Taishin, thank you for once again jumping in.
as always, happy to do what I can. Thanks for the question, Tetsuho, and it comes up against the thing that stood out to me most in this chapter. Comes on page, I think it's 277 for those of you that want to look at the book. This is section 5, where it's talking about working with the 5 hindrances of attachment and aversion and boredom and restlessness and doubt. Sokyo mentioned that, you know, they practiced or worked with most of the techniques that are suggested there. If you have a thought of ill will, maybe think of a positive thought instead, or just don't give attention to it. But when we get to the end of the list of techniques, we find grit your teeth, put your tongue against the roof of your mouth, crush mind with mind if you really can't stop saying nasty things about so-and-so. And this struck me to not be in the spirit of our practice, Soto Zen practice, Shikantaza, as I understand it. Our practice isn't to go to war with the mind, to conquer the mind, to fight it, but to trust it. In fact, there's at least one sutra that I know all of you out at Jikoji probably chant regularly, sometimes called Faith in Mind or the Song of Trusting the Mind. And so I really felt the tension there, and I wasn't sure how to resolve it. And then I thought, maybe I don't need to. There are many different traditions and styles of practice, and some will take this combative approach, and others will take a more trusting approach to working with thoughts that arise, feelings that arise, perceptions that arise. And so a question similar to the one that you offered, Tetsuho, that I had for the group was, do you share this understanding of our style of practice, that it's about trust, not so much about combat? And have you tried this technique of trying to crush mind with mind? And what's been your experience? Or if you've had an experience where that just didn't work and you sort of had to trust that in time it would all work itself out. I'll share that going to war with the mind has never worked for me. So I've just given up on trying. And that made all the difference.
Tetsuo?
I would say, thank you, Taishin. I would say, is trust the same as faith or similar to the word faith? I would say that I do incorporate trust in Zazen, trust in my Buddha nature being available to me and being already here. That's where trust comes in for me on a daily basis when I sit down and do this sort of like this enactment ritual of whether it's meditation or not, I just do it. And so, yes, I find trust is really important in my daily meditation. Thanks for bringing that one up.
Nansen, I think you might have wanted to jump in, and this would be a great time.
Yeah, I'm very wowed by your discussion, so thank you all. It's beautiful and wonderful and stimulating. All of these questions seem to me obviously very related. Actually, with Jackie's first question, they all seem like a little spider web coming off of that. And because you're all kind of fetching about the same thing. It's like they're robbing us of our joy. They're taking this into this realm where it's brutal and we're clenching our teeth and I think you have to back up and remember, I think someone has mentioned that he was, consider his audience, right? Consider his crowd. his crowd was monastics. And so I think that's important to remember. And I also think that, again, someone said not being quite so married to the literal words, that if you zoom out a little, you can see that he's not saying not to enjoy joy and sex and food and everything, probably not wine, but he's not saying to deny oneself life, the richness of life. He's suggesting that you have to understand that in the moment of joy, part of what makes it so precious is that it's fleeting and impermanent and everything's changing all the time. And that's the operative, that's the where the road meets the rubber meets the road here in this chapter. He's trying to teach us that if you can keep in mind that this body itself is going to be, you know, not so attractive someday, maybe already, that it is, you know, the fact that it's changing. So enjoy the joy. Enjoy everything that comes to you, because it's going, going, gone. So I think that's really important, that you can understand the fleeting nature and the impermanence of everything, and that it's just not going to stay. And that's a central teaching. To me, this is the first three of the ennobling truths, this chapter. He's teaching us, yeah, you're going to long for things. You're going to have sloth and torpor. Those are some of my favorites. You're going to have all these experiences, and then what do you do with it? And how do you relate to your longing and your suffering? And understanding the insight that arises is that you can be happy even when you're not experiencing bliss and joy and rapture. You can still be okay. I want to add that the thing that really excited me this chapter was the most minimal thing, but I really loved it. And it's on page 282. It's said many times, but it says, "And how monks does a monk dwell?" This is the four foundations, or he calls them establishments of mindfulness. You know, folding your legs, sitting upright, straightening your body, and establish mindfulness in front of him. Establish mindfulness in front of him. So that's shikantaza. Establishing mindfulness in this moment without any object, just what's here. I really love that. Establishing, I find it actually totally inspiring. Establishing mindfulness in front of her or him. In front, just this experience. I don't know. I just find that really inspiring. Like, that's what we're doing. Establishing mindfulness just with right in front of us. And I think that's all I have. When you're ready for a poem, I have a poem too, but not yet, because I'm sure you've got more to say.
Who would like to enter the conversation and has not yet had a chance to share their reactions to this chapter or a question for the group? Emmy, I'm establishing eye contact with you because I know that you're in the room and you can't escape.
Hi, everyone. I'm enjoying the talk and the chapter as well. And the Buddha did give us some different references about how we can practice mindfulness, depending on who we are, because it reminded me that we are our own lamp, so to say, and that we're going to establish our mindfulness in our own way. So that makes me think of the trust that Chris brought up. But I'm just talking, but I did have something to share. The one thing that I thought to share was in the mindfulness of breathing. It was on page 290, and it was another one of let's see, I guess I should go there instead of just blabbing. Oh, yes. So it was at Savatthi, the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down. And then he was asking. And then, of course, it led into the four things which, when developed and cultivated, fulfill seven things. And then the seven things, when developed and cultivated, fulfill two things. So the way I understood this is that it was almost like math to me in a kind of exponential example where one thing would grow into another. Or lead to another, or becoming more and more. And my take on it was like our bodies, you know, all our cells kind of reproducing and multiplying, and our thoughts and our minds and our five senses and our smell. And I don't know if anybody's getting what I'm saying, but that's just the way it struck me. And I liked it for that. The way it had me kind of imagine that, I guess. And that was also maybe a way of remembering what he was saying. And then if I had a question, which I'm gonna see if I can put it into a question. It was the achievement of mastery. Page 296 to 298. And I'm going to, I'm just going to turn to page 298 because I remember this is what he kept continuing to say. But it must be because I making, mind making, and the underlying tendency to conceit have been thoroughly uprooted in your mind for a long time that such thoughts did not occur to you. And that was a conversation, of course, between two of them. So I was wondering, some of my thoughts, and then I'll ask the question, some of my thoughts were, well, conceit, aren't they way past conceit here? And then it occurred to me, well, yes, it would be the mind that's not grasping. It would be the mind that's not attached to feeling of gaining or conceit. So here's my question. When the mind is fully at rest or being realized, do we drop the mind? Or do we occasionally drop the mind to be enlightened? I guess I'm just going to leave it there. If anybody could.
I mean, could you restate the question?
Sure. Okay. So, for enlightenment, do you think as humans, do we drop the mind to, because if enlightenment is an activity, so are we aware of like our five skandhas without attachment? But not the mind? Like, do you know what I'm saying? Is that? So anyway, my question is, do you need to drop the mind for enlightenment? That's my question.
It's Bill.
Bill, please dive in. Thank you, Emmy.
No, the mind, this is chitana, is momentary. And we cling to it. And we're obsessed by it. And we reach subtler and subtler levels of attachment to the mind. But one of the goals, it seems to me, in what they're saying, what the Buddha is teaching, is because of the momentariness of everything, The mind is impermanent, but it's still a mind. The mind comes back. It's Pamela's thing. Every moment, the mind comes back. It's not the same mind it was before. It looks similar, but it's not the same. And with regard to all of the hindrances, if you read the language that they're using, we're not reading Pali language, but I think the translations must be pretty accurate. They're talking about obsession by, trapped by, not just not having them. It's the obsession and the attachment and the I make a copy of all the words that I come across. And there must be seven different words in there for what you do. And it's not just getting rid of it. It's recognizing that it's momentary and not becoming attached to it and assuming the ultimate goal is to get rid of the ahamkara, the self-maker, making of an I. So the mind's still there. It's just there's no I attached to it. That's my reading of what this chapter is saying.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
I have a comment unless there's someone new that hasn't spoken.
Tova's getting back in the pool.
I'm intrigued by these comments on page 297 of the descriptions that are speak to experiences I've had in which I think, Emmy, it would be a time in which that conceptual mind has stepped aside. And so these lovely descriptions, I entered and dwelled in the base of the infinity of space. Mm-hmm. So that spaciousness that we can get to. Another one, the base of the infinity of consciousness, and the base of nothingness. So I look at those as that experience that I've described several times to us over time. Of when I get into that, literally into that infinity symbol in which the teeniest micro and the largest of the macro are continually interfacing with each other. And I'm somewhere in there, but I don't know if you'd call that mind or self, or I think it's pretty much diffused when those states occur. Many of us have those, I think.
I'm going to do the thing that we did not want to do, which is to call on a few people who have not yet had a chance to jump into the conversation. And Michael and Juliana, I was looking right.
Let me beat you to the punch, so I'm not called out.
Thank you.
So to answer an earlier question, and I was thinking a lot about this, what I do when I sit is, for me, it's all, I guess, a death meditation. Every breath I'm letting go, realizing that this is all momentary. The I is impermanent. You are impermanent. We are all impermanent. So I'd say, to try to summarize or offer a conceptualization of what I'm doing when I'm sitting, right or wrong, it's letting go. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's harder, but with every breath, I'm just appreciating the full value that has been my life up to this moment and attempting to let go with varying degrees of success. So that's what I'm doing when I'm sitting. And I think one of the things that really, a question I have about this is, I was gonna ask everybody, are you more in the serenity or the insight? Because I think there's some really interesting studies coming out about, say, hypnosis, that we find that certain people are gravitate towards certain things or skilled in certain areas. But what I really wanted to focus on was, a few people had mentioned the bandits and the saw, and approach the, you know, treat the bandits, hold them in loving kindness. And sometimes reading this material, I have an issue with what I view to be the passivity of it all. And this, there's been a lot written about this. This is nothing new, although I'm coming at this as a new student, is the again, the passivity and the allowing, well, I think that there is something to be said for righteous indignation. And where does do these philosophies, where do they play in social justice? And I know the context of this, but I don't know. I have an appreciation and a basic understanding of the context of this was shared for a specific audience for a specific effect. But here in the 21st century, sometimes what I'm reading, the passivity of it and the just being, embraced and holding compassion and loving kindness, is that really always the right way? I think one of the things that I really am attracted to about Zen is what I perceive to be the artistry of it all, the spontaneity of it all, the coming at life full force and dancing the dance while I'm here. And I think the presentation of a lot of this material is so axiomatic and so loving kindness, I really have a hard time grasping and appreciating that, because I do think that sometimes, not necessarily tied into attachment, but I think that there is ample opportunities, particularly now, although I'm assuming there always been, for righteous indignation, to move towards social justice, to be angry. I think that I don't see an incompatibility with being angry and practicing Zen. So I guess that was a very broad-based ranting question that I had. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Jerome is goading me a little bit.
Okay.
I was saying, oh, it's tempting to talk. And he said, oh, just jump in. Michael, I really appreciate your comments. And I think it's a really good thing for you to practice with anger and righteous indignation. And can you do that without a self? Can you do that without an identity that's righteously indignant? Is it all about you when you're reaching out to protect other people? Can that same righteous indignation take the form of love and compassion for the fact that people who are violating all the rules basically are just like you? You are them. Their causes and conditions are really not that different than yours. They're acting differently as a result. So, can you have them be together? Not separating them into the bad guys and being righteous, but just meeting it. And I don't want an answer.
You do want an answer?
I do not want an answer, but
Well,
you can say one if you want one. But I just think it's a really good place to live in this
yeah,
world.
I agree. No, I don't think it's about me and me being indignant, but it's understanding that there are victims that get hurt, that are trampled over, and they still have to pick up the pieces of their lives. I think that's
And
what it's about.
we should help them, no question. This is not about standing by and saying, oh, let it be, let it be, let it be. That's ridiculous. That's not. The Buddha's whole teaching is about you have a choice. How are you going to be wholesome? And you're talking about being wholesome, right? How are you going to be wholesome? But anger is a poison to your wholesomeness. It might give you a lot of energy, but I think it's a really, really good place to practice.
Yeah. I guess I'm looking at, in the 21st century, we have these amazing technology and the ability to immediately communicate with others around the world. And in so many ways, we really do live. We live in the same world. We live in a radically different world. And I really do think anger is a poison, but I'm wondering if it ever there's ever a again a righteous place for it. I understand that is something I'm thinking about. But yeah, thank you for the response. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it too.
Mark, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm good.
Diane, I'm not asking you to putting too much pressure on you, but we have not had a chance to hear from you, and I want to make sure everyone has a chance to use their voice tonight. So anything to add by way of an insight or a question about this chapter?
Well, about 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to study the Satipatthana Sutta with someone who had trained with Bhikkhu Anilayo, who has a 256-page guide to the Satipatthana Sutta. So when I read this, somewhat familiar, but I mean, Bhikkhu Bodhi, man, he's like, I'm going to get the high points of the whole Pali Canon right here, you know? So I was drawn to the meditations that Bhikkhu Anilayo, he has the guidebook, and then he also has audio recordings. So for me, I mean, I'm not so articulate, you all are all so learned, and I'm just so appreciating the discussion and what everyone's saying is, but it all goes to the same place. If I can paraphrase Suzuki Roshi, the practice is the practice. It, you know, everything else is extra. And studying the Satipatthana Sutta, the different ideas about how you can be with what is and let go. And it was, you know, like I got a lot out of there is this body. And, you know, I live in this branded society where it's all about my appearance and how I look. And at work, I was always telling myself. And, you know, there's kind of a liberation going, yeah, my eyeball by itself, you know, holding up these beautiful people and just going, well, individually, not so much. I don't think what else. Yeah, a lot of teachers that I've trained with, so I give thanks for people like Bhikkhu Anilayo and then, okay, while that was going on, so imagine there's 256 pages and there's 9 chapters, each with like 5 subdivisions. But so I decided I would supplement with Joseph Goldstein at the Bari Institute. I can't even pronounce if that's right or not. He has umpteen talks about these very things. So that really helped, you know, inspire me. So to me, a lot of the teachers I train with, it's about letting go and being with what is. And he talks about bare knowing. So, I mean, sometimes we can get off. So like anything here about celestialness and devas and just, I just kind of like skip on through, but I think we have a good practice and a good way. And, you know, again, I want to not be so much in the construction realm because I can just go off. I love the 5 hindrances. I think I had heard those before I studied the Satipatthana Sutra. And my favorite is, okay, I did have a question. Okay, and then with the Satipatthana Sutra, the factors of awakening. So I don't think of them so much as, okay, then I'm going to have this one, and then this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. But just that some ideas that I can change the channel. And, you know, like if I'm in this balled up ill will, I can go, well, maybe it's time to say hello to my parakeets, or breathe the diaphragmatic breathing or something like that. But just a lot of teachers I really appreciate when they just talk about the lack of efforting, you know, just being with what is. And that's so hard, right? Just the letting go and being with what is. So anyway, I didn't really volunteer anything because I rarely have any questions. And then it's sort of like, well, how could I, you know, even begin to comment all this vastness? But there's such a sublime pleasure in attending these and listening to what people have to say. So I hope that, so, okay, let me ask a question. All right, it can be pop-up style because I've been counting the minutes and going, please don't call me, please. and then I want to cheer, yeah, go Tyson, yeah, come jump in again. But if everyone had I love the, in Reverend Bhikkhu Anilayo, and so I really respect him because he knows Pali and he also knows Chinese, and there's really 3 different Chinese translations of the Pali Canon. I went to another teaching where it was 16 90-minute things on the Vimalakirti with someone who knew Sanskrit and they knew the 3 Chinese versions, and they went from the Robert Thurman. So I can see there's such a big difference in translations. But I liked how in Reverend Alayo's version, it's a factor of awakening. Like these things wake us up. So I have a favorite, and I would like everyone to say what their favorite factor of awakening is. And it's not like it has to be a sequence, because I just think they just happen, or, you know, maybe pick one. I don't know. But my favorite, I was surprised that it could be joy, you know, because it's just like grinding out and sitting on my cushion and wearing out, and then wearing out the han. We're going to have a real party when we break it, you know, just like simple joy, just simple contentment. So that's my favorite factor. So I want to hear what everyone else's favorite factor of awakening is.
I'll jump in. Compassion. Others.
It's joy.
Juliana, we haven't heard from you. Do you have one?
You know, I feel like I'm still sort of absorbing everything. I am still pretty new to all this. And I don't really have that as much as I think for me, this chapter really got me thinking about, you know, serenity and insight and what that means to me. And I think I sit down on the cushion and that's what I really aim for. But it's like, okay, well, actually, I should just let go. I should just be. And I think when I do that, it's really when that comes. So it's, I found that interesting. And yeah, what comes first, chicken and egg, you know, the serenity or the inside of the serenity. So not much to say, except for that just got me thinking about all of it. This whole chapter did. And again, it comes back to the letting go. It just keeps coming back to that and being in the present moment and just kind of being where you are, being okay with where you are at that moment. So that's kind of what the chapter meant to me.
Thank you. Backing up to Diane's question, anybody want to share a word?
It could be your favorite hindrance. Mine is ill will.
Energy.
Good one. I'm going to suggest poetry as the word.
Oh, yeah.
Looks like Bill has something.
Bill, did you have a word you wanted to jump in with?
Two words, but they're connected, torpor and distraction. Mm-hmm. Cool. I have a favorite, unwholesome choice.
Anybody else got a favorite hindrance?
I would say restlessness, because I'm always jittery and doing here while thinking about that and trying to do 10 things at once. And I really want to focus on doing one thing at a time. So restlessness.
I agree, or I would add doubt for hindrance. Is that a hindrance, right?
You could also add a favorite enlightenment factor.
I would also add for myself doubt as an enlightenment factor.
Wow. Jarrow, you're very, very thoughtfully quiet there.
Are you distracted?
Are you distracted? Matt, oh, you can talk, sorry.
Oh. I think for me, an enlightenment factor is gratitude. When I gave a talk a little while ago, I gave the story of the person who was said to be a nun, a woman in rural Japan, and later I found out she wasn't a Zen Buddhist nun. She wasn't even a Zen Buddhist. She was in the Pure Land tradition, called the Myokonin, and sort of a revered or enlightened layperson. And according to the translation in English, she, when people came to her with all kinds of problems, whether they were physical or mental or relational, she would always advise them to just to wake up in the morning and say, "Thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever." And then some people, you know, were very grateful, and other people tried it out and they said, "Well, this is useless. Let me try something else." And so a typical person came back to her after 6 months trying it out, and he said, "My life is just as miserable as ever. So what can you advise for me?" And she said, "Thank you for everything. I have no complaint." And then that person apparently understood. And so when I looked into this attitude of gratitude, it's really remarkable what it does for the mind, that whatever comes to you, whether it's seemingly positive or negative, the attitude of gratitude is one of reception, receptivity, full receptivity. So then when this comes, you are able to respond or carry on in a more enlightened, so to speak, way, because you really get it. And with your whole beings, so to speak, and you don't, you have no complaint whatsoever. So you have, you're not immediately responding with some kind of judgment. So I found it just a remarkable teaching. And then I asked my friend Shujiro in Japan about this woman, because I had initially heard that she was a Pure Land person, but everything online, I looked her phrase up online, and everyone gives the story that she was a Zen teacher of some sort. So anyway, he found out that she was this a Pure Land Myokonin. Also, what she said in Japanese was not "domo arigato gozaimasu" at all. And she spoke in words which are more or less what Amida Buddha would say. And first, the first words are something like, it is no impediment, or it is no problem. Something rather, you know, sort of colorless like that. I mean, from my perspective. And then the second comment was, "I have no need for anything," or "I don't ask for anything." So I was really amused how this story has changed in recent time. From what she actually said to what maybe works better for us in our time. Mm-hmm. So and I feel this about this whole reading that we are doing this in this book, because the Buddha spoke in his time and spoke to what was relevant for his time. And then, of course, what was actually recorded and remembered and so on was what was suitable for those people in their time. And now, in our practice of Buddhism in our time, we are especially appreciative of things which are not particularly necessarily strongly mentioned, even in this text. Especially in regard to the mind being open and willing to let thoughts pass and drop them rather than beating them up and crushing them. So it's delightful how tradition comes and changes according to what is needed. So I really value the appreciation of the tradition and understanding how tradition really works many times for our benefit. Not always, but many times. Thank you.
Jeru, thank you for putting a cherry on the sundae of this conversation. So grateful to you. Marco, do you want to?
I think it's time for a poem, and then we'll do the three refuges.
Okay, this is also from the Theragatha. Remember, these are nuns, first nuns. This one's by Sakula. From a good home, her name means. I once gave all of myself to being the perfect wife and mother. Then I heard the teachings of the Buddha. I saw the arising and passing away of what was wife. I saw the arising and passing away of what was mother. And said goodbye to my children. What was left, I gave to the path. Oh, my sisters, you never had to be perfect. If there is something in these teachings calling out to you, it's because something in you is calling out to these teachings. The path will take you whenever you're ready, just as you are.
Thanks, Nansen.
Beautiful. Thank you. Let me just do one comment
before
we do that.
Go ahead.
First, I wanted, in closing tonight, I wanted to say thank you in advance to Jackie Pasco and Taishin, who next week will lead us through Chapter 9, Shining the Light of Wisdom. So looking forward to that conversation. Also wanted to thank everyone tonight for becoming so engaged with the conversation. It's really, really good to hear your voices. And this is such an interesting, complex, layered book. And at the end of the day, I think what I'm hoping for, and which felt like I got a great meal tonight of, is how does this relate to us and to our practice and how we follow the path in our lives now. So thanks for opening your hearts for this conversation. It was really great to hear from all of you tonight. So most grateful.
I have a brief announcement.
We have an announcement.
Just want to briefly say that kind of tuning with what Michael spoke of social justice and bringing our practice to the sidewalk. I'm remembering Ben Conley sitting on the sidewalk in his robes. There's someone visiting Los Olivos, she's visiting next door to me. She's a 21-year-old girl from Nepal. She's never left her family. She lives in Kathmandu. But she comes from a family in which there's been consciousness of HIV and human trafficking, and she is now devoting her life to work mostly with direct relief. And my next door neighbor's, she's a program manager for direct relief. So this young woman, whose name is Kanthi, which means revolution, because there was a medical breakthrough in that she's alive at all. She's a very strong, balanced, beautiful young woman, and she will be speaking next Tuesday evening in Los Olivos. And she's only here for a couple more weeks. And then she's going back to Kathmandu. She and her mother do work with survivors. So if anybody's around, she's going to speak at Samsara Winery, which is where our beginnings began. Nenzin can speak to that. That's where we met Koan. Anybody's interested, that's 6 o'clock, Samsara, Los Olivos, next Tuesday.
Do you know if they'll be doing a Zoom way of accessing?
I haven't asked if there's going to be recorded, but I can certainly ask.
Okay. If we get that information, we'll forward it out to our group.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that moment.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Do we have anyone that would like to lend their voice to lead the pages? I see we don't have Ekuro-san's not here today. Would anybody like to chime in?
Thank you, Anton.
So if everybody could mute themselves except for Anton, we'll go from there. Thank you.
Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Dutyampi Dhamma saranam gacchami. Dutyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatyampi Buddham saranam gacchami. Tatyampi Dhamma saranam gacchami. Tatyampi sangham saranam gacchami.
Thank you so much, Anton. Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. We'll see you all next week.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. See you.